that last point, just to sort of drive it home, that they typically rely on these additional grants, awards, and donations. They couldn't do it without it, so that's why they're often public charities, because they do get those kinds of donation sources, and it helps offset any kind of increased costs of loss mitigation efforts targeting in these particular areas. So they do. I think the private foundation, not private foundations or other funding sources, do play a part in this on the top level as well.
Mm-hmm. Then I wanted to go to an example of something. Oh, we're over to you, actually.
Yeah. well, so, and also there's another one. I don't have a slide for it, but the New Markets tax credit. There's also something, if you heard of CDEs, not to confuse everyone, there's CDFIs, there's also a CDE, which is a community development entity. And to be a community development entity, somewhat similar, you have to be a legal entity, have a primary mission of serving low-income communities, and maintain accountability to the residents of the targeted low-income communities. Oftentimes a CDE will demonstrate this last one. It's an interesting concept, this idea of maintaining accountability to them, to the residents. They often will do that by demonstrating that they've filled at least 20% of either its advisory or governing board positions with representatives from the low-income communities. I found that sort of interesting because I think there's parallels there where, you know, in terms of just other markets for DEI inclusion, other things that we're talking about, that's a really interesting sort of threshold and standard there. And so going into economic opportunity zones, qualified opportunity zones, Congress created this through the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 to encourage investments in economic development projects by providing tax breaks and waiving capital gains obligations. The goal is to encourage and subsidize the cost of infrastructure in challenging real estate markets that catalyzes growth, such as roads, transit, water, sewer, education, and public safety. That was sort of the goal. And I'll go into also a visual of this. And I'm starting in 2019, and I'll tell you why in a second. But to sort of show the full effects of what was originally contemplated. So you say you're an investor, you have capital gains. If you want to take those capital gains within 180 days and invest it in a qualified opportunity zone fund, a qualified opportunity, you would then not recognize the tax on that capital gain. If you hold on to your interest in the qualified opportunity zone fund, within 5 years' time, you would get a 10% increase in your basis, so you wouldn't have to recognize 10% there. If you hold on to it for an additional 2 more years, 7 years total, you would get a 5% step up in your basis that you wouldn't have to recognize. And then you would ultimately recognize that capital gain you made back in 2019, not until 2026. So you could defer the recognition of the gain, plus you get a 15% step up in basis. So again, it was really trying to encourage people to invest in these qualified opportunity zone funds in the first place. And then the nice kicker on this is, if you hold on to it for 10 years, then your appreciation on the qualified opportunity zone fund itself, if that has gain, then you don't have to recognize it. So 2019, well, it's 2023, right? So what do I do now? It expired in starting in 2022. You don't get those increases in basis, but you do get to defer your capital gain until 2026. So there is still that benefit of doing that. A definition of the Qualified Opportunity Zone Fund is that at least 90% of the property has to be in a state-designated Qualified Opportunity Zone area. So how did you get to be classified as a qualified opportunity zone? And that was based on state-nominated communities that were from an eligible group of low-income census tracts. So they did have to have, there were certain census tracts that were doing it. The U.S. Department of Treasury certified those nominations, but they were all done by the state nominations. And so there were some controversy around that, because sometimes the qualification was a little bit broader, and so certain places that may have already been up-and-coming areas were included in these qualified opportunity zone funds. But they did have at least a certain requirement around it. So this is, I was talking about a place-based investment tax incentive. They have a unique advantage as they often have bipartisan support. We just had a presentation earlier about it becoming more polarized in a political climate. This is something that often will get a lot of people's support for different reasons from both sides of the aisle, because it does have this goal of increasing investments in certain target areas. It helps investors, it helps communities, it works like that. And the place-based investment tax credits, it's not rocket science, right? We realize that a lot of times poverty is clustered in social settings, in neighborhoods, schools, political districts. So these are settings which represent a crucial site where American inequality is generated. And so to invest in these places is important. You know, and we've also seen it, the COVID's made it worse, but a lot of times when people are wanting to leave cities, it's the people in the upper and middle class that are able to leave and have the most mobility. And with that, housing rates declined, structures get, there's abandoned structures, increase in criminal activity. It sort of multiplies, has multiplying effects. And so here, these place-based investment tax credits are really trying to sort of stop it and reverse it and have more investment in there, have more of the community's help.